Today's show is sponsored by Quater. Quater is the new footwear and accessory brand by Travis Matthew. It offers incredible comfort and performance without the gaudy and distracting branding that you'll find on most performance shoes. Quater is committed to making products that fit seamlessly into your everyday style. Products filled with useful technology that can enhance any look while providing unparalleled stability all day long. So check out quater.com/SBNation to learn more. That's quater.com/SBNation.
Batter up.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to A Pod of Their Own. This is, I think, the first time that we've done two off-season recordings 2 weeks in a row, so that's very exciting. I am Allison McCaig. This is episode 34 of A Pod of Their Own, and I am joined by my lovely co-host, Linda Surovich. Hi, Linda.
Hey, Allison.
And Maggie Wiggin. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Allison.
Hopefully this week I sound less sick than last week. I was trying to hide it from you guys, and it didn't work out so well. I sounded pretty terrible. But this week, I think I'm on the mend, so that's good.
Yay.
Yay.
Maybe the Mets are on the mend as well, at least as much as they can be. Since we last recorded last week, the Mets have signed two players, so that's exciting. They signed...
Well, and had a major, payroll upheaval as well.
Yes, also true. So they signed both Michael Wacha and Rick Porcello, and it was kind of a roller coaster of emotions, because it was basically the sequence of events was they signed Michael Wacha and you're it's a fifth starter type. That's kind of what we thought they might do. And oh, look, the deal is cheap and loaded with incentives. Seems very Mets. And then they also signed Rick Porcello. And you're maybe they understand depth. And then there's all these rumors that are now they're going to trade a pitcher since they have a huge surplus of starting pitching now. And you're just Jesus Christ.
And they're still falling for that two bad players equals a good player thing,
yes. Which
wasn't true when it was backup outfielders, and it's not true now with way past their prime starters, but that's fine. I guess two bad players is better than what we expected, which was one bad player, so okay, I'll take it.
And it was the predictable... the predictable thing is predictable. We all saw Rick Porcello coming. This wasn't a shock. As soon as, in the offseason, as soon as the day one of the offseason, it's they're getting Rick Porcello. There's no doubt. And that's exactly what happened. And then I think he said they were the first ones to call him this offseason.
He did.
They called him at 6:51 when the game ended at 6:50.
Hey, Rick, you're free agent.
He did also say that and this is just taking him at his word. I don't know why he would lie, but, we don't have actual evidence other than his word. He did say that he had two better offers than the Mets offer on the table. He said that he had another team had offered him a 1-year deal like the Mets offered, but for more money. I think the Mets deal is 1 year, $10 million. And I think the other deal was 1 year, $14 million or something like that. So he had that. And then he had another offer on the table, supposedly for 3 years. Who knows what the AAV was on that. But he said he wanted to play for the Mets because he grew up a Mets fan. So we've got Brad Brock and Rick Porcello, the Mets, and we had Joe Panic. The Mets really love their local guys who love the Mets.
Stroman,
and Marcus Stroman
too.
Yes.
I'm such a sucker. Mention I love the Mets, and I'm I will fight, I will defend you to the death now. Rick Porcello is the best signing ever, and I won't hear any slander against him.
Yeah, it's kind of Rick Porcello kind of sucks. And then it's I love the Mets, and I grew up a Mets fan. Rick Porcello's amazing.
Look, Rick Porcello sucks, but I would die for him.
Would die for him.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Would die for my
I would lay
boy.
Down my life.
These are not mutually exclusive things.
And Rick Porcello is from extremely my neck of the woods of New Jersey too, 15 minutes from me. So very, very excited about that. I had known that I actually knew that he was a Mets fan already before he said it, because my dad's colleague at work, like, their kid was on the same, like, baseball team as Rick Porcello growing up. Like, they were teammates. Oh. And so he knew that Rick Porcello, so my dad's coworker knew that Rick Porcello was a Mets fan. And so my dad said, Rick Porcello is a Mets fan, so they're probably going to sign him.
Your dad.
Well, I think also the Mets do have, whether earned or not at this point, they do have a reputation for getting good pitching. I mean, if you think about what they got out of Bartolo, I mean, Bartolo Colon was not like a earth-shakingly great pitcher, but given his age and his stuff when he arrived in Queens, like what they got out of him is probably like a top 15%. Like expectation that you would get from him. So it kind of makes sense also that, you know, if he's looking to maybe get a bigger deal next year, if he wants to try to find the right place to have a bounce back, then Queens might be it. I mean, I don't know if I totally agree, but I can see where the thinking is along those lines.
And it's today the anniversary of the Dickey trade.
It is, like, because Dickey Andy Martino's was another having a meltdown one. On Ugh. Twitter.
Yeah, let's forget him. But still, like, Dickey's another one. Like, sometimes taking a flyer on a dude does work out.
Yeah.
It's true.
And I think, but I forget who it was. I'm trying to pull up the article now. Very riveting radio. But there's, oh yeah, here we go. It was Tom Verducci of Sports Illustrated wrote a piece over the weekend about how, Rick Porcello may end up being, like, a huge value signing, because he looked at most pitches thrown ahead in the count, and Porcello was up there in the top four with Max Scherzer, Justin Verlander, and Garrett Cole. So sounds like one of these things is not like the others.
I mean, but that's also the kind of thing where I'm like, show me the logistics of how that works. Like, show me why that matters more than other things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It seems like it could be one of those things that's just arbitrary enough that you sort of get weirdos sneaking into the top like that. But we'll see. It would be nice. I'm not buying what he's selling, but
at least
great.
He's durable.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's a thing.
And, like, I feel like they, you know,
unlike Waka.
Yeah, exactly.
He's the opposite of Waka.
It's kind of the two players equal one player philosophy playing out. Like, oh, we took a risk on a guy who used to be good, but he's hurt all the time. But then we just have this other guy who's kind of mediocre, but he doesn't really get hurt. So maybe their powers combined.
Or Rick Porcello will meet his match with the Mets.
Oh, yeah. Oh, like, there, anytime injuries or an injury-free player meets the Mets, it's like immediate implosion. Like, Cespedes was healthy before he came to the Mets. I think Cano was too.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Cano extremely was. I mean, obviously, like, he hadn't missed any significant time before. Obviously, he missed significant time when he had to serve his suspension for performance-enhancing drugs, but he hadn't missed a significant amount of time in his whole career before that. And then, obviously,
Yeah.
That's happened. But speaking of Cespedes, I feel like we do.
Speaking
have to talk
of Cespedes.
About that part of things. So, another thing that happened since we last recorded is that the Mets, basically reached a resettlement agreement with Cespedes on his 2019 salary. And it, like, got slashed by, like, $10 million, right?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
And at least that much. I think I was hearing buzz that it was like 14 million cut from this year, from 2020.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if we've gotten confirmation on the exact numbers yet.
But it's more than rumors. 10 million.
Yes, yeah. It's definitely more than 10 million.
Yeah. So it's a lot of money that the Mets are getting back. And I mean, there are obviously, like, many factors at play. One of them, which obviously we may not ever know the full story, but people, you know, are speculating that this Cespedes wouldn't be settling with the Mets and taking this big of a pay cut if there wasn't something else to his whole he tripped in a hole in, on his ranch story.
Yeah, like when they showed up and they're like, that's what got hurt. It wasn't from riding horses. It's like, nobody asked if it was from riding horses. And they're like, well, it wasn't. It definitely wasn't riding horses on his ranch.
My it wasn't from riding horses t-shirt has people asking a lot of questions about my shirt.
Yeah, yeah, that was a strange day.
It was really strange. But it definitely
strange. When they first like... said he broke both his legs, then they're like, oh, wait, no, it was just one leg in two places.
Just one leg really bad.
That's like, and that if that's not peak Mets, we thought he broke both legs, but it turns out to have just been one in two places. That, to me, feels like that's Mets right there.
Oh, it totally was.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it certainly sounds like the alternative was basically that his contract would have been voided. Like,
yeah, they would have tried to
the entire remainder. And, like, and that the union probably wouldn't have let them make this resettlement if that wasn't a serious option. I don't know. I feel really bad. I like Cespedes so much. And, like, I have no way of knowing if, like, he has been, if, like, they've been tougher on him than on other players in similar situations. But I know that the world has been tough on him in general. And I just, it just really sucks for him. And I wish it had gone differently. And I wish, you know, I wish he hadn't not ridden those non-horses. But,
yeah,
you know, at least maybe there's a chance that we'll see him because there are a lot of new incentives to maybe get him back on the field.
Yeah. And I mean, he has been doing baseball activities, loosely defined as that is. But he has been taking batting practice, running, doing like very minimal stuff. Hopefully we do see him sometime next year. But the ultimate result of this for the Mets is that they get a lot of money back under the competitive balance tax, which was probably a big motivator for this whole thing. Because before, now, make no mistake, the Mets were getting Cespedes' money back regardless of what happened with this resettlement. They were going to get it back either through the insurance company or via a resettlement. So the only difference between those two things is from the competitive balance tax perspective. So this resettlement now means that that salary that the Mets would have paid Cespedes that he is now forfeiting is not counting toward the competitive balance tax, which means that the Mets should reinvest that in the team. Will they do that? I don't know. Probably not.
Well, they've already, like, disentangled themselves from basically the last decent remaining reliever on the market in Betances, who, like, I will admit, I really want to sign him because he played for the same little league that my son played with, so I have kind of a soft spot for him, and I was really, really hopeful that it would work, but like, needless to say, I'm just kind of like skeptical that it's actually going to happen.
Yeah,
but I don't know how you can sign him and then without signing somebody else too, because you have Lugo's UCL hanging on, you have Gazelman, who had a bunch of injuries last year.
You definitely need, like, a bunch of them.
Yeah, so you have bone spurs for Edwin Diaz. So it's, like, the bullpen's already barely bone hanging on as a thread.
Ulmer. I'm going to work it out. Hold on. I'll get back to you.
But so you already have an injury-plagued bad bullpen, and you're just adding another... I mean, he's not bad, but another injury person, you don't know how he's going to bounce back after last season. He faced two batters last season?
Excuse me, Linda. Yeah. We just learned that Fangraphs.com projects that the Mets will have the sixth best bullpen in baseball next year.
Oh, well, excuse me. I have been proven wrong.
I was like, I saw that and I was
Has
like, that's
Dan
how.
Been drinking early this year?
I was like, that's how you know Steamer is borked.
Yeah, go home, Steamer. You're drunk.
Go home, Steamer.
I mean, Justin Wilson's good,
I guess. Justin Wilson's good. Like, you know.
And Drew Smith coming back from Tommy John.
Honestly, it's probably just that the system looks at three-year averages.
Yes.
And while last year would be the most highly highly weighted, you'd still have the projections would still be factoring in a very significant weight from Edwin Diaz's like incredible 2018 numbers. So yeah, that in and of itself could drive that way up.
Pretty much does, yeah, because I think the total WAR projection was like 4.4 or something, which was good enough for sixth, and Edwin Diaz was like 1.9 of that or something.
Yeah.
And obviously Lugo was a high portion of that too.
I mean, the thing is, you could see it happening. Like, it's
sure.
But like, you don't want to count on it happening. Like, you don't want to go in and assume, well, all right off the bat, Diaz is going to be Cy Young caliber. Like, that's just not how you plan for a baseball team. And like, for sure, they need more than one new reliever, but right now they have zero.
Wait, excuse you, Maggie. They added Lugo and Gesellman.
Those were bullpen additions.
they added them from
themselves.
From themselves, like they
because
were
words don't have meaning anymore.
They're like, well, we were thinking about putting them in rotation, but then we decided not to, and that means they're new.
That means it's a bullpen addition.
I just that is an all-time, like, what did he just say, sports agent-y NBA type line. That is like chef's kiss. Mwah.
We're comfortable with their catching depth because of Ali Sanchez. Lugo and Gesellman are bullpen additions. I just, can't right now.
I mean, here's a question. Can Ali Sanchez pitch?
Maybe. I mean, we know Kevin Plawecki can. He has a 0 ERA.
We've fixed it. We've done it.
Yeah. Well, maybe JD Davis can pitch. It's still my dream. I just want to see JD. Yeah.
But yeah, so the Mets were in on Betances, now seen as unlikely, according to John Heyman. So we'll see about that. But then
SNY tweeted they're like far from done. It's like, but yeah, they're not doing anything.
So like,
when all the players that are better than him already signed. So, you know, it doesn't bode well if they're still working
out there. That would be a good.
Oh, I forgot that Will Harris is out there.
That would be a good. I mean, I think that's too much to hope for, but that would be a good signing. Mets, please. Do that. That'd be great. But
Mets
I'm sure
are like, say
just
no more. We signed Willie Harris.
I think we're overlooking Chasen Shreve here.
Yes, critical.
He's going to save our bullpen.
Chasen Shreve. Yeah, I think
sounds like
on
a made up baseball name.
I think counting on Diaz to have a big comeback season is the definition of a what if, wouldn't you say?
Uh-huh. Yeah, what did Brody say?
Well, that's what the Mets are obviously doing.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah, but, I mean, Brody flat out lied to us when he was hired. He's like, it's my job to eliminate what ifs and blah, 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 blah. And that's all you've done.
Yeah.
It's literally every move you've made, it's been a what if.
Well, they're going to sign a bunch of NRIs and then be like, we eliminated all the what-ifs because look at all of our subpar depth. It's like, that's not what we meant.
Well, I guess maybe the starting pitching isn't a what-if. But if you, unless you trade one of them.
They got to stay healthy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the catch.
And, like, ironically,
we're still close to Walter Lockett season.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
And I'm not saying that I'm weeping over the loss of any of these guys, but ironically, they've lost like half their AAA depth to Korea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Drew Gagnon and
Chris Flexen.
Chris Flexen, that's right. All baby Flexen. Boy, did they bork up his development.
Yeah,
yikes.
Poor Chris Flexen. I hope he does well in Korea. Yikes.
Chris Flexen always reminds me of the shy kid from Polar Express.
Oh, aww. My God, he does look just like him.
He looks exactly
he also
like
is,
you.
I'm fairly sure, 9 years old.
Yes.
Oh, he totally is.
Like, that was the problem. You should not have a 9-year-old pitching in the major leagues. I've seen both of the movies. It just doesn't work.
I remember when Joe Smith was on the Mets first time around, like when he was like a baby still, and he looked like that. He looked like he was like 2 years old. Like, my dad and I used to call him the apple-cheeked Joe Smith.
Oh, Didn't he just sign?
Yes, for 2 years, $8 million at Mets.
Bad. Deal.
Boy, that seems like it would have been a good player to go and pick up that salary for. But
he's
okay,
had a nice
that's fine.
Career.
Yeah.
He's been good ever since he left the Mets, which is usually how it goes. But, you know, why not bring him back?
They should. They should have. But
I guess Colin McHugh is still out there.
That's true.
I do like Colin McHugh.
I do, too.
Signing. They need to sign, like, at least one, if not two, more bullpen guys. But
I mean, they looked at it and said, yeah, that bullpen blowing up, we want more of that next season.
Yeah. Unwatchable. Let's see it again.
Yay. Also,
well, that's also what
they seem disinterested too. Yeah. They seem disinterested in signing a backup catcher also, so.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's another thing. Well, we got...
So glad they're getting all that salary back from Cespedes. Going to great use.
Cool.
With nothing.
Very cool.
But, like, something's got to be done, because... At this point, why should the Wilpon spend? They're cashing out, so they probably want to get as much money as they want or as they can before they leave. Like, what incentive do they have to spend right now? They're lame ducks.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to think that there's some pride, some, like, desire to succeed at that which you have attempted. I don't know, it seems pretty obvious to me, but, like, this is where I am, and that is where they are. So
we don't operate what do in the I same know? Reality as them.
Yeah, I'm not in Greenwich right now, so.
No. Even Fred has shown a willingness to win, just they go about it the wrong way. So I don't know why they're content to just be like, okay, we'll see what happens while everybody else does everything else. Like the Phillies.
Going out, not with a bang, but with a fart sound.
Well, to be fair, that would be a perfect Wilpon ending.
Yeah, right.
How else would they go out?
Making fart noises on the pod. It's very mature and exciting radio.
You all knew what you were getting into when you turned us on today.
Yeah, you all signed up for this.
This is not a surprise to anybody.
No.
No. No, we're not mature people.
On that note, we will take a break, and then we will return and do an actually very serious and good segment. And I feel like it's a timely segment, too. In one sense, it was long overdue because we've been meaning to do this episode for a really long time. But then the sale of the Mets happened to a new owner. So like this topic became particularly timely once more. And we're going to take a page out of Rob Wolf's Unformidable book and go back in history a little bit and talk about a time when the Mets had a very good owner. And we're going to dedicate an entire segment to Joan Payson. So stay tuned for that.
This episode is sponsored by Calm, the number one app for sleep and meditation. By now, you know what a healthy diet and exercise can do for your body. But have you considered what training your mind can do for, like, every other part of your life? Calm has teamed up with LeBron James to help you train your brain. If you want to sleep better, reduce stress, and perform at your best, you need to try Calm. Calm is loaded with guided meditations, soothing sleep stories, and tons of chill soundscapes, including peaceful nature scenes, which are LeBron James' favorite, helping him get the sleep he needs to perform at his physical and mental best. For a limited time, our listeners can join LeBron in using Calm with a 40% discount to an annual membership at calm.com/SBNation. Unlock content to help you focus, ease stress, and sleep better. Get started at calm.com/SBNation and get 40% off an annual membership. That's calm.com/SBNation.
Hey, I'm Jason Del Rey. I recently wrapped up Land of the Giants, The Rise of Amazon. In this podcast, we examine how Jeff Bezos turned a small online bookseller into one of the most powerful companies in the world. We start by exploring how Amazon Prime became a service with over 100 million members and the main source of the company's power.
I mean, I think that's kind of what Amazon's banking on, right? That you're just so locked in that you're not going to go to any other sites, because, I mean, I don't.
And we end the season by pondering the question, is Amazon too big?
You know, and we just don't want to be the United States of Amazon. We just really don't.
Land of the Giants has been recommended by the New York Times, Axios, Wired, and more. It's a candid look at the state of Amazon today, how we got here, and what the future might look like. The entire first season is out now. Find out more and binge it on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.
And we are back. For our last episode before we take a two-week hiatus for the holiday season, we are doing a very special segment today about former Mets owner Joan Payson. We are doing this segment because it was the topic requested by our lovely listener, Ellen Lidner, who won the Choose a Topic prize at our Dollars for Dingers fundraiser. So it's long overdue.
Could not have been more appropriately won.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. She was such a good person to win this because I knew that she would come up with an excellent topic and she did not let us down. She challenged us to find as much information about Joan Payson as we could. She was like, there isn't much out there. I wonder if you guys can find more information about her than I can. The answer is, Ellen, we couldn't really. Unfortunately, Joan Payson is woefully undercovered when it comes to baseball history. If any of our listeners out there know of like a book about Joan Payson or a book that extensively covers Joan Payson, send it our way so we can shout it on the pod, because I looked at my library. I did a lot of looking on Amazon. I even looked in the academic literature to see what I could find on like JSTOR and stuff to see if there's some historical archive I could find. And I came up with essentially diddly squat. But there is one article out there, a really good one from the Society for American Baseball Research. Bless the Society for American Baseball Research. They do such good work on historical figures in baseball. The article
really is rigorous.
Yes.
Like really like well cited and well written, just really solid.
Yeah, so a lot of the stuff cited in this article about Joan Payson is from like contemporaneous news articles at the time, like New York Times articles from like 1924. That like to do that research ourselves, we would have had to have like gone in the microfilms in the library to find it. So this article is by Joan M. Thomas. So I wanted to give the Society for American Baseball Research a shout, as well as Joan M. Thomas, who happens to share a first name with our subject, Joan Payson. That's where essentially all this information is coming from. So I encourage you to read the full article if you have some time. It's not super long, but it's like basically the most extensive article about Joan Payson that there is out there. So we're kind of just going to like summarize the important points of Joan Payson's life, celebrate her life, do a little bit of discussion about women in baseball. And that's kind of how this segment's going to go. Rob can give me notes after this. Rob Wolf, give me notes on how to do like a historical baseball podcast, because you're much better at this than me. But yeah. So Joan Payson was born on February 5th, 1903. Into considerable wealth. She came from a fairly wealthy family, I think, on both sides. And baseball.
Yeah, one of those like traces your family tree back to the Mayflower, literally.
Yeah.
Like literally the Mayflower. And that's always kind of wild. That is definitely like not my stock, but she has a very interesting like familial background.
Yeah. And one of the cool things about her is that she clearly was like a debutante, right? But like,
yes.
She didn't act like one at all. She was like super badass and down to earth, and like wasn't like prissy and like, you know, above it all like many of these like rich people are. So it's pretty cool.
Also, although she was not it.
Just reading about, you know, the high society back in those days, and yeah, like her coming out in society, like the debutante ball, it's like, it's so like yeah, that's such an interesting time period in in American history and like in the 20s, like that's what you grew up in, the highest society in the 20s with these like fabulous, you know, I think they had like a huge house or something in, I think, Long Island. I think they Long Island
and multiple enormous houses.
Yeah. So it's like, it was just so much fun to read about, just like, you know, for somebody who loves history and loves that time period, like, that's your owner of the Mets.
Yeah, and at the Payson estate, they had all these horses because she was super into horse racing. That was the other thing.
Yeah, the whole family. It seemed like her mom was a big horse racer.
Yeah, I'm just very
not horse racer. Like they were not riding these horses. Let me
unlike Cespedes, they're not riding.
They
horses.
Were owning the horses.
Yeah, they went up to Saratoga regularly, I think.
Yeah, and she could bet a quarter when she was a little girl.
Yeah, which is awesome.
Well, and the fun thing, I can't remember if it was that article or another article I found, where they said it was funny that she would always be standing in line waiting to cash out her $2 winnings when she owns millions of dollars.
Yep, but gotta get that $2. So yeah, horse racing was the other big thing in the family that she was really into besides baseball. But she also really cared deeply about both medical research and the arts. She invested heavily in both. There are many, many hospitals in the New York area that basically owe their part of their existence to Joan Payson. She invested heavily in hospitals and medical research, and she also was an ardent art collector. She had a lot of really rare pieces. So, you know, parallels to Steve Cohen, I guess, as far as being an enthusiast in the arts and collecting art. So that's pretty cool.
Well, also, what was near and dear to my heart was she had a bookstore, a children's bookstore.
Yes. That
and
is
she
also
opened
a fact.
It the day before the stock market crashed in 1929. But it somehow it survived for 10 years. It survived. And then I think she did expand to adult literature eventually. But, you know, opening a children's bookstore, I was like, oh my God, I love you.
Yeah. So just overall did an incredible amount of charitable work in addition to owning the Mets. So that's really cool. So not only was she wealthy, obviously, but we talked about Linda mentioned her debutante ball, her coming out ball. So she ultimately met and married Charles Shipman Payson in 1924, a Yale graduate and business tycoon. So he was rich by his own right. So together they were, you know, mega rich. But
I wonder if related, I believe related to the Payson who, there's at least a Payson playground around Manhattan named after a Payson, and I think there's a few other notable Payson locations.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, me either.
Considering how much she gave.
Yeah.
And we're gonna get back to the story behind her acquiring the Mets, but I found it interesting that the biographical sketch of her in the New York Times immediately after she bought the Mets referred to her only as Mrs. Charles Shipman Payson or Mrs. Payson. They didn't actually use her full name. So that just, you know, goes to show that not much has changed between now and then. And, you know, women were always treated as people only how they relate to their husbands, which is pretty frustrating. She was wealthy in her own right. She didn't need his money to buy the Mets.
And she was, you know, doing good on her own. She was educated. I think she went to Baruch College. Was that it?
Barnard.
Oh, Barnard. Yeah. So obviously very smart, very educated.
She definitely had the society track at Barnard. She was there for a year.
That's true.
Was there and doesn't that seem the way to do it? Show up to college, take three or four classes, and then buy your way out of there. I don't know. Yeah. I get it. Yeah. Oh, you know what? It's also the Jeff Wilpon track.
That's very true.
Accurate.
Very accurate.
So a couple more before I get to the bit about her buying the Mets. A couple more random factoids from her early life. So she unfortunately, her and her husband's oldest son was actually killed in World War II at the Battle of the Bulge, which I didn't know.
Yeah, super sad.
awful, right? So
yeah.
So like burdening that, taking on that grief while like almost like not too long later, like trying to run a baseball team is like crazy. She had an active role in politics throughout her life, at the Women's National Republican Club, which is still there, and it still holds the same name. The building is still there. The group is still active. So the story of her, getting the Mets is she was out to lunch. Every rich person knows each other, as we've discussed previously on this podcast. So, you know, yeah,
they just sit around and talk about their plans all day,
their plans for their money. So she had a luncheon conversation with stockbroker and New York Giants, minority owner M. Donald Grant, who said he always wanted to manage a team. And she was like, well, I always wanted to buy one. And she was, for those of you who don't know, Joan Payson was a huge New York Giants fan. Huge. Grew up a huge New York Giants fan.
I think she owned like 10% of them or something. Because she was one of the ones that voted against them leaving.
Right. During that luncheon conversation with M. Donald Grant, she already owned, a tiny piece of the Giants at that time, but she convinced him to sell her his share of the Giants. So then she became like a 10% owner or some more substantial percent owner of the Giants. And then when the Giants majority owners decided to relocate the Giants.
Yeah, she tried to buy them out.
She tried to buy them out and didn't
really wanted it.
Successful. She was heartbroken over both the Giants and the Dodgers leaving New York, especially the Giants, because obviously that was her team. But she was totally devastated by the departure of the Giants and the Dodgers from New York. So she desperately wanted to bring National League Baseball back to New York.
Getting a little ahead of ourselves, but with the connection with the Giants, she was really the driving force in bringing Willie Mays to the team.
Yes.
Because he was her favorite Giant. And really, I mean, like, who can blame her for that choice? Like, that is a clutch choice for your favorite Giant.
Right. And so, like, her impact on baseball is, like, far-reaching and goes beyond the Mets, not only for the historic nature of her being the first woman to ever like buy a baseball team outright, but also for that, because she wasn't the first woman owner. She was the third woman owner, but she was the first to ever purchase a baseball team herself. So that's worth noting. So she was like groundbreaking in that regard. Knowing that how devastated she was and knowing how invested she was in bringing National League Baseball back to New York, William Shea kind of knew that Joan Payson was the perfect candidate to own the new New York franchise. So turned to her. She bought the team. The naming ceremony of the Mets took place at Payson's Manhattan apartment on May 6th, 1961. And the fun part of that story in the article is that the Mets PR man spilled a drink on Payson's $50,000 rug, which, oops.
That's relatable. Like, hashtag relatable right there.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I feel like that would be me.
And I feel like that's such a fitting, like, first thing to happen to the Mets franchise.
Yeah, start playing Yakety Sax.
Yep, basically. And like a $50,000 rug at that time, like, oof. I mean, oof, how much is that worth now? I don't know, a lot.
I mean, not much. It's stained with wine, I think.
Well, you know. So yeah, like I said, she was the third woman to own a baseball team.
Did she want to name them?
The Meadowlarks.
Oh, the Meadowlarks.
Which,
yes.
like, don't get me wrong, we stand Joan Payson. Meadowlarks is a terrible baseball team.
Yeah, I'm glad she was overruled on that.
Nobody is perfect. Nobody is perfect.
Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the biographical sketch referred to her as Mrs. Charles Shipman Payson. And not only that, but contemporaneous articles at the time, like, referenced her looks like all the time, and referred to her as a woman that dresses simply and wears little makeup. Like, these are details that we like never hear about from the male owners. Like, imagine if in a random article, like a male owner, like they described how he was dressed that day. Like,
he was
especially because a lot of these guys do tend to get kind of rumpled and lazy looking, but it doesn't matter. Like, nobody actually cares. It's just one could care if one wanted to.
As Fred Wilpon discussed the sale of the Mets to minority owner Steve Cohen, he was sporting his favorite red tie.
God.
It's just ridiculous. So moving on to the phase of her life where she just was owner of the Mets, my favorite fact in this entire article is just like, I was like, oh my God, I stan Joan Payson so much. Like, she is me. Is that she carried a portable radio around with her, like, all the time to listen to baseball games. So she carried it with her to the racetrack, because obviously she spent a lot of time at the racetrack too, because her family had all these thoroughbred horses they were racing, and she spent a lot of time at track. But she would carry the portable radio with her and, like, sit in the corner and, like, listen to the Mets games. And even better, when she went to all these, like, high society dinners and balls, she put the radio in her purse, which
I love that so
amazing
much. I feel like my words can't express how in love I am with that.
Yeah.
The one thing that the thing that I really loved is not only did she keep score at every game, but she used her own unique method that she had developed, that the only description that was given for it was that it was kind of like cuneiform. And that's crazy.
That's
like,
so cool.
That I definitely nerded out. Although, like, definitely in the vein of, like, the rich are just like us, she would have her chauffeur keep score for her when she was unable to. So, like, I totally relate to Joan Payson, except that my chauffeur is such a dick about keeping score for me. So,
jeez. Yeah, replace that guy. But yeah, I guess if I was lucky enough to have a chauffeur, I would probably do that. I'd be like, I can't go to the game. Can someone else keep score for me?
How else were you gonna, you know what happened? There was no Twitter.
Right.
I need to know what happened.
She wasn't there, apparently she would receive the scores by mail. Which is funny how times have changed, right?
She's like my spirit animal.
Yeah. Speaking of animals.
Yay!
Yes.
I love this part.
She loved dogs, apparently. Which
especially dachshunds, doesn't? Which, like,
yes,
okay,
yes.
Sure.
So that's great. Fun fact, she loved dogs. She also loved kids. And I think, yeah, I mean, that's evidenced by, like, her investments in medical research and children's hospitals and, like, kids' bookstores. She clearly was a big mother figure.
And she was very, like, very, you know, wanted to be very connected with, like, the players' families, too.
Yeah.
When they had kids, she would, like, give them gifts. And there was one, I can't remember whose kid it was, she described as a Mets baby. And, like, I think that rings very true, I think, to anybody in the Mets community who has had a baby. Like, there are Mets babies and there's every other baby.
Yeah.
And, like, it's just a special thing, and it's kind of cool that she was part of that from the beginning.
Yeah.
Well, I saw one thing that said they were only, like, when they first started out, they were a team that only a mother could love. So that's kind
that
of how
right. And she's,
yeah.
So that's how she kind of got, like, this grandmotherly kind of aura about her. And then she was always seen, like, with her grandkids at the games. Like, she was always playing cards with them at the games.
Yeah. So she was definitely, like, seen as this matriarchal figure. And she was described as friendly and approachable to players and fans alike. And she, you know, we said that she kept score at every game. And she sat in the stands like a regular fan. And, like, former Met Ron Hunt said that she looked like an ordinary ball fan when she was sitting in the stands. She, like, just sat with everybody else, kept score, ate hot dogs, ate chocolate ice cream was her favorite. So it's just like she just, like, mingled with the commoners, so to speak, and just hung out at the games all the time. And Ron Hunt's wife, Jackie, made a point to say that she made you feel like family. So, like Maggie said, she was, like, really involved with the players and their families, and they all knew her and could approach her and talk to her. It seemed like she was really beloved by everyone in the Mets community during the time that she owned the team. So that's really cool too.
Can you imagine Jeff Wilpon sitting in the stands eating ice cream?
Nope. Sure cannot.
No, like, not gonna happen. And like given her background, like that's pretty incredible, you know.
Imagine having an owner like that who just like would hang out with all the players.
Although but, this, did they, I mean, Mike, I guess, did they have luxury boxes? Like, what was the...
I'm not sure. That's a good question.
Alternative.
Yeah, I don't know how the polo grounds, yeah. But I'm assuming it was the polo grounds at first.
Yeah, at first.
Yeah, but she was still, like, very much active with the team, although I think it seems like her health was starting to be a bit of an issue. It was as late as 69 when they won the World Series. Like, she was not there for much of the playoff run because she was sick on vacation. But then she was there for the World Series. So,
yeah.
So at least through into, so she was there into the Shea years.
Yeah. She was there into the Shea years, but like she had to stick out a lot of like terrible seasons early on to get there. Like people,
yeah, she
like,
did.
Obviously, like I was going to say people forget, people don't really forget like how bad the Mets were because they were historically bad. But just like she supported the Mets through thick and thin for the remainder of her life. And it's incredible that like, you know, and she always kept like kind of a positive attitude about the whole thing. It was funny. One of my favorite quotes from the article is at the beginning of the 1963 season, obviously this was on the heels of the historic 120 loss 1962 season. She said, if we can't get anything else, we're going to cut those losses down at least to 119. So it's like good that she kept like a good humor about the whole thing and like kind of, you know, saw the long game, I guess, knew that like eventually things would get better. And I'm just really glad that the Mets did win the World Series once for her.
Yeah, that seems very, very well deserved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Her mark was everywhere on those early Mets teams. She's responsible for Casey Stengel being the manager. Mm-hmm. She's the one who went to him and said, we want you to manage the team. So, you know, Casey Stengel, obviously beloved figure in Mets history too, but Joan Payson is the reason why Casey Stengel was the manager. Speaking of when the team won the World Series, so in 1969, when the team overtook first place, she cried, which relatable again.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
If I had been around then, I would have also cried.
Oh, for sure. I like full on like sobbing.
Yeah,
I cried just sort of thinking about it when I not quite cried, but I got very close to crying just reading that part of this article.
Yeah. And obviously this comes at this segment also comes at an opportune time too, because we're winding down kind of the celebration of the 50th anniversary of this World Series win. And I thought a lot about this while the ceremony was happening on the field, like, and they were trying to pump the current Mets up, like, we did it and so can you. And honestly, the 2019 Mets, like, kind of almost pulled it off. Like, they almost pulled off a similar miracle to come back from the doldrums. But, like, I thought a lot about how truly improbable that was. And it's just incredible to think about, like, what other reaction could you have but cry when that 1969 team, against all odds, was in first place, finally. Like, wow. Oof.
That's wild.
It's crazy. Like Maggie mentioned, she was sick with bronchitis when they won the National League East. So she missed, like, the end, sort of toward the end of that season, but returned during the playoffs. And she was there in Baltimore for the World Series games. And she covered her eyes with her scarf during the final play of Game 2. Again, highly relatable content.
Yeah, that's like me changing the channel. Like, it's too tense. I can't watch.
I think I watched nearly the entirety of Game 5 of the 2015 NLDS, like, through my fingers.
Oh, my God. I couldn't breathe.
I was, like, jumping up and down in front of my, like, in front of the couch. Like, not jumping up down like, woo, they won, but like throughout the entire game, like bouncing back and forth because I could not sit my butt on the seat. I just had to like bounce the entire time.
No, I was
time.
Legit like hyperventilating, like full on.
My husband was fairly concerned for my well-being.
Yeah. I just remember what? Various times during the 2015 playoffs, I would like like my wrist would buzz and I would look down at my Garmin and it would say I was exercising because my heart rate was so high. It would be like, you're in cardio. Right. And I'd be like, sure am.
Like, no, I'm in cardiac arrest. They're very different.
I remember my back just hurting because I was so tense and like so hunched over. And like my back just would hurt for days afterwards.
I just remember how sick I got. I was like, by the time, because I was up late and I was at a bunch of games, by the time the NLCS rolled around, I was sitting there in the 30 degree weather at Citi Field running like 101 degree fever. Oh. I should not have been there. Oh, yikes. Man, that was a bad choice, but it was a great choice and I would do it again 100 times out of 100. But I was hella sick.
Yeah. Jeez. So,
that worked. Like Joan is definitely like if she was there, she was there in spirit, probably doing the same thing we were.
Channeling Joan. Definitely channeling Joan.
Definitely.
They won her that Miracle World Series title. And that was basically like that was the highlight. After that, obviously things declined for the Mets once again in the 70s. Although they did have that Miracle 73 team. But kind of Joan's health took a turn for the worse after that. And after suffering a stroke, she died on October 4th, 1975. And she died just a week after Casey Stengel died of cancer. So it's kind of crazy that they died in the same week, that the two of them are so like inextricably linked to each other in Mets history. I think a lot about how, what was it? It's which two founding fathers died on the same day? Wasn't it?
Oh,
it was like Jefferson and Adams. Maybe.
Yeah.
I think it was those two.
I think they died on the exact same day. It made me think of that, how these like two giant figures in like in Mets history died in the same week. And the pair of them were the first inductees into the Mets Hall of Fame when it was created in 1980, and fittingly so. At the funeral, the church vicar said, "There is no way of measuring the impact of Joan Whitney Payson on the world," which I think is such a great, like, just a great line. Like, that's so good.
I'll also say, so something that I had talked to some older generation Mets fans in my family about Joan Payson, and independently, two of them both said that, like, the thing about Joan Payson is that if she had been around, they never would have traded Tom Seaver. And it's one of those things where, like, I guess because that happened after all the rest of the stuff, that's the thing that stuck. Like, that's the feeling they have when they think of Joan Payson. They're like, oh, if she'd just been around, would have saved Seaver. And, like, I thought that was really random and interesting and, like, says so much about how she was perceived by the fans, which is, you know, a little maybe different than how she was perceived by, like, the New York Times.
Yeah.
And how we can't relate to that. Like, imagine loving your owner.
Yeah, really. Imagine. Among the things, I just thought this was, like, cool. Among the things found at her Long Island home include an autographed photo of American poet Walt Whitman, along with the copy of his famous work, Captain, My Captain. And it just makes me like feel like that kind of goes full circle with David Wright, and how if she had been around during like David Wright's tenure as a Met, how much I think she would have loved him. And it just, the whole like Captain, My Captain thing is obviously like a big thing that Mets fans like said to David Wright during when he was retiring and at his last game and everything, because he's probably the most, you know, one of the most celebrated figures in Mets history, along with Joan Payson. And was
oh, I tweeted it many times using that poll.
Yeah,
for you to rise up. Because I just wanted him to rise up and hear for you the bugle trills.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna cry. There's no crying in podcasting.
No crying in podcasting.
I think Joan would disagree. I think she knows that there is plenty of crying.
She knows.
I will say one thing that I thought was really interesting is that, like, I think she has a wonderful reputation. It seems to have been well-deserved. But one thing that struck me as just interesting is that, you know, something a lot of fans, not even just Mets fans, but lots of sports fans will complain about is when they think of their owners as meddling, as, like, being involved in the baseball ops side of things. And she meddled all the time. Like, she was a major part of the the baseball operations team, or, like, what would have been the, like, they didn't call it that. They just called it, like, the people who make the baseball choices. And it's not to say that, like, she was good or bad at it. I honestly don't think we could really know, you know, how good or bad she was at that side of things. You know, the way we know that the Wilpons are bad at it. I just don't think we could have that kind of information at this stage. But, like, I don't know, it's just, it did strike me as interesting that, you know, while in many ways we think of, like, the perfect owner, I think we talked about this just last week, as being someone who just, like, signs the checks and shuts up and goes away. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't her.
No, yeah.
Like, not at all. No. And again, like, I don't know that that's a good thing or a bad thing or just a neutral thing. I just thought it was really interesting. It just changed a little bit of how I had pictured her as fitting in with the, like, collection of historical sports ownership, you know?
And I don't think, like, any owner was that way back then. Like, I don't think any owner was sign the checks and shut up back then, really.
No.
I think that owners were historically way more heavily involved than they are now. Because I feel like they didn't, like, there weren't really these, like, advanced baseball ops departments the way there are now. So I just feel like it gave the owners room to be a lot more heavily involved, in the day-to-day operations of the team, because there weren't whole teams of people taking care of it.
Yeah. And while, like, everybody owning a baseball team for obvious reasons was very wealthy, it also wasn't this, like, multi-billion dollar enterprise.
Right.
That it is now. So I think it lends itself much more, or the former model would have lended itself a lot more to, like, tinkering. Like, let's try this thing. Let's bring over Willie Mays. I miss Willie Mays. Like, that's, you know, I think that's something that really, was easier to get away with back then.
Yeah. And, like, yeah, and I just think it's kind of striking that, because I'm currently looking at the list of Major League Baseball owners currently. And I am confirming that not a single one of them is a woman.
Yeah, no surprise there.
Yeah, no. Surprise there.
I mean, obviously, some of them are, like, for example, the Atlanta Braves are owned by, like, Liberty Media as a thing, as, like, an entity, not a person. But, like, there's no woman who is a principal owner in a major league team right now. And so, like, yeah, like, Joan Payson was a groundbreaking person back in 1962, but very little has changed since then. Like, we haven't had too many female owners in Major League Baseball history.
Yeah, and, like, if her, you know, if her upbringing and political involvement is any indication, like, I doubt that she really saw her owning a baseball team as, like, a radical act. I don't think that would have registered with her as, like, you know, as, like, an expression of feminism. Like, that, I just don't think would have been any part of her vocabulary or her intent. But I still think that she would, if she were around, she'd be like, wait, what? Nobody?
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't seem right.
Yeah.
And that's just, I don't know, that's just really sad to me that, like, I don't know, she broke ground, but then, like, they just put it back together again. Like, it feels very backwards. And
yeah, it's kind of like, I feel like so much is made in the world of, like, women doing anything, of, like, breaking the glass ceiling. And obviously that's, like, really important. We need pioneers to be first. But then so much is made of, like, this woman was the first. And they keep saying that, and then it keeps being like, you're kind of like, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy when you keep being shocked that a woman is the first or the only or one of the few to do something, and it kind of like goes, it like counteracts normalizing it.
Yeah,
in a way.
But and also, I don't know, it kind of makes me proud that the Mets have had such like a long legacy with women, you know, given Jeff Wilpon aside, but you know, she was the first to buy a baseball team. They had Jane Jarvis, who was the organist for a long time. Now we have Marisol, who's one of the few, if not the only, voice PA announcer in the major leagues. There might be one more, but I don't know.
I think she's just the only Latina.
Okay.
Yeah, she's definitely the only Latina.
Okay. And I don't think there are many.
No, I don't think
many
so.
Many women of other backgrounds. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to say there's maybe one or two others. And then, you know, we have Jessica Mendoza. You know, you could, you know, argue about her conflict of interest, but she's still in the front office. So it seems like the Mets are one of the, have a history of being one of the more progressive.
Against all odds.
Against all odds. I know, shockingly
despite
enough.
Their best efforts.
Yeah.
And also, I was reading up on Jane Jarvis. She also had a very interesting life, too. She was orphaned because both her parents got hit by a train.
Wow.
Jeez.
She, yeah.
I didn't know.
And she was on an episode of To Tell the Truth. And she was, she was posing as like an ant like specialist, like somebody who, like they had written a book about ants. And so at the end, I'm like, oh, this seems like an interesting episode. I'm going to watch this. And so at the end, she was like, oh, I'm the organist for the New York Mets. And everybody was blown away. I was like, yeah, that's right.
Maybe we'll do future pods about other, like, badass women in Mets history. That'd be
good. That is your suggestion.
I was going to say, Jane Jarvis was a classically trained musician. Like, she's had an interesting life, too.
Yeah. That's definitely awesome. Yeah, I think like I said, you, like, much is made of breaking the glass ceiling, and it's great, and we should keep encouraging women to break into new fields. But like, once the glass ceiling is broken, you need to enable women to be able to do something with the pieces. You can't just leave them there with them. You know?
Yep.
We need to keep encouraging it. Otherwise, the first doesn't really mean anything if it doesn't set a precedent for something bigger. You know, gotta keep following Joan Payson's lead, and do everything we can to honor her legacy, which includes writing more about her. Like, geez.
Yeah.
It's like I said, a plea to our listeners, if you know of some article or some book out there that I don't, please send it our way. And if you don't know of anything and nobody can come up with anything, I encourage someone who is a much better writer than I am to write a book about Joan Payson, because I would read the hell out of it.
Yeah, so. It definitely seems like a topic ripe for more investigation.
Yeah. But in the meantime, our listener, Ellen Lidner, is not just a person who is an enthusiast of Joan Payson's. She is a cartoonist and illustrator based in New York City, and she drew the wonderful The Cranklets Chronicle, which is a zine about women in baseball. And she drew one of those issues is about Joan Payson. So I highly, highly recommend you check out Ellen's work. Her zines and comics and illustrations are absolutely wonderful, and The Cranklets Chronicle is a joy. I enjoyed reading it so much. Right exactly up my alley. I love comics, and obviously a comic about women in baseball, like, hell yeah. So it was awesome. So one of the issues about Joan Payson, highly recommend you check it out. You can check out her work on littlewhitebird.com, and you can check out her Etsy shop of the same name, Little White Bird. You can find her on Twitter. What's her handle? I have it written down here. At Ellen Lindna. So it's ELLENLINDNA. So at Ellen Lindna. Check out Ellen's work. Her illustrations are absolutely wonderful. And we thank her for suggesting this topic to us. We highly loved doing it.
I hope we did her justice, too. I hope we did. So. I hope she enjoys it.
Yeah, I hope Ellen liked it, and I hope you guys liked it, too. We really loved reading about Joan and learning more about her life. So, this was fun. We hope to do more segments like this in the future. If you want to hear more segments like this, let us know. You can email the show, aa.apodoftheirown@gmail.com. You can also DM us on Twitter. Let us know if there's a person that you'd like us to do one of these segments about. So in the meantime, we are going to take one more break. And when we get back, we are going to close things out like we always do with walk-off wins. So stay tuned for that.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
And welcome back. We are going to wrap up the show this week with walk-off wins like we do every week, where each of us talks about what is making us happy this week, baseball related or otherwise. Linda, what is your walk-off win for this week?
Well, my walk-off win was I'm such a sucker for foxes. I love anything foxes. I'm currently wearing a fox bracelet.
I have a fox sweater that I really love.
Oh, I have a fox sweater too. I love it so much. So, you know, now that I'm a children's librarian, I have to plan programs. So I decided to do a little something different. And I had the kids make a fox cozy that you could put around your mugs and your cups. I use mine every day to put around my mug Dunkin' Donuts cup. And it's so cute. I'm so happy with how they came out. So one of the girls came to my program. She made one. And then our town where I work did a tree lighting ceremony, and she came and she ran up to me because they were serving hot chocolate, and she was using her fox cozy on her hot chocolate the next day. God,
sweet.
I was like, oh my God. And so her parents were like, we couldn't leave the house without it.
Oh God, the poor parents. It's so easy to lose.
I know. Oh, but that just that's warmed awesome. My heart so much. That made my night. So, you know, it is little things like that that, you know, a lot of times, you know, it is stressful and, you know, planning programs and, you know, doing everything else that you have to do over the course of the day. But, you know, it's little things like that that, you know, it's so rewarding. It makes it all worth it. So I'm glad that she enjoyed her little fox cozy on her hot chocolate, which, you know, I use it too. I'm so glad I did it because I did it. My plan was to, you know, do something that, you know, they would get use out of and that was different. It wasn't just coloring or, you know, stuff like that. So that was the highlight of my night. So that's my walk-off win.
That's so happy. I also love foxes, and fun fact, my Patronus in Pottermore is a fox. So,
oh, I'm so jealous.
Very pumped about that. When I got that Patronus, I was like, yes!
I can't complain too much. Mine is a winged horse, which is pretty cool. Yeah, I can't complain, but oh, I'm so jealous of the fox.
I'm trying to remember who I was with. I was with one of my friends, and we were, like, doing the quiz together, and they got, like, a super lame one, and it was kind of hilarious. Oh. It was, like, a fish.
Oh, that's such a letdown.
I also thought of, so speaking of, like, Maggie, I think you would especially like this story, because parenting, like, can't leave the house without it, because it's easy to lose. Oh, that made me think of a, like, very traumatic moment from my childhood. I had a favorite baby.
And
its name is Tuffy. It's
I had Tuffy.
Tuffy's my favorite.
I love Tuffy.
Tuffy was like, I slept with it. It went everywhere with me. Like, it was like my very important beanie baby. And one time my mom and I were out shopping. I think we were at a Target, and I left it in the Target bathroom. And we were in the car ride home, and I just like was wailing. I was like, Tommy! I was like having like a full blown meltdown. And my mom, of course, like we had to drive back to the Target and like find the Beanie Baby. Luckily, someone had like handed it in to the like customer service desk.
Oh, yay!
Yay!
It doesn't always work out like that.
So, yeah, it doesn't always work out like that. Sometimes it works out. Well, my brother had like a giant stuffed Tweety that he loved. And aww, he lost it once, and it ended, like, they couldn't find it, and it ended with, like, them having to buy a new Tweety, which is...
Yeah, when kids leave their stuffed animals at the library, I'm like, I need to put this in a safe spot, because I'm like, I know how kids get with them, so I always, mm-hmm, like, keep them at the desk to keep them safe. I'm like, oh, man, I hope the child could go to sleep tonight.
Yeah, right?
Oh, well, glad Tuffy was rescued.
Yeah, Tuffy was rescued. It had a happy ending. This is walk-off wins, after all. Wouldn't have told the story if it didn't have a good ending. Anyway, Maggie, what is your walk-off win for this week?
My walk-off win, I think this is going to be probably a first and last for a walk-off win situation, but my walk-off win was my office holiday party, which every year... So it's the whole school, and it's like a holiday breakfast, but they really go all in. I mean, it's a Columbia graduate school, so, you know, it's the school of public health. It's not like it's a school of, like, neurology or whatever. But they make a clear investment, and it was a really nice party. They always have an omelet station, and, like, they had live music this time, like, some jazz. They always hand out mimosas freely, but this time they had spiked cider that was spiked. I got myself a new, like, kind of subtly glitzy Christmas sweater with like some gold in the patterning, and I got a mani with gold and red glitter that just feels so festive. And like, people actually commented on it. They're like, oh my God, your nails look so festive. And I was like, thank you. I was really hoping they would.
thank you. I tried really hard this time.
And it was just a really nice party. Like, the food was good and the drinks were good. And I, you know, have been to enough of these things at this point. I've been to Columbia for like 12 years that I know where to kind of hover to catch the fun people that I like to hang out with. And yeah, it was a really nice office party. So that is the one and only time an office party will be anybody's best thing of the week.
Yeah, that's hearkening memories back for me of grad school, because my department holiday party during grad school was also always a breakfast. I feel like maybe graduate schools who need to do like cost saving measures like to do breakfasts because it's cheaper. That's probably why that is.
But I don't know. I know Johns Hopkins, like, I know some of their grant numbers, and y'all are doing just fine over there.
Yo, I know, but also like during like my last year of grad school, they like got really mad at how much free food that we were giving out, like as a whole school, not just like my department, like the School of Medicine. They were like,
that seems like a very predictable thing for an incredibly wealthy medical school to get their panties in a knot over, like, geez, guys.
Exactly. They were like, oh, I know that we're Johns Hopkins and everything, but you guys have too much free food. So we're going to put extremely stringent restrictions on when you can give out free food. So we stopped having free food at Journal Club. And I was like really upset. And I was like, well, I'm graduating at the right time. Peace. No more free food. But we
to be fair, we don't even invite students to this party. They have other parties. This one is for faculty and staff. But yes,
that's nice. Sorry. Our breakfast is a combined everybody thing. In the whole, like, in the whole department, the Institute of Genetic Medicine within the School of Medicine. So it's not the whole, it's not the school-wide party. I think there's also a school-wide party, but I never went to that. It was only the, my department. So yeah, it was also always a breakfast. So yeah, holiday breakfasts are nice.
That seems like the way to go, honestly.
Yeah. Load up in the morning, then go do some experiments. Yeah, man. Grad school life. So my walk-off win for this week is a shout out to our fellow Mets podcasters, Jeff Panastro and Jarrett Seidler. They had their For All You Kids Out There which is the name of their podcast. They have their like hot stove meetup that they have every year last weekend. And I went into the city with Michael and we went to the meetup and it was really fun. And I always really enjoy hanging out with everybody, whether it's an Amazing Avenue meetup or a For All You Kids meetup or just like anytime I get to hang out with my baseball friends, I really enjoy it. So I got to meet some new faces as well as hang out with some familiar faces. So that was just a really fun time. We played a really fun game of Jeff's Invention, which was basically like he went around and had us rank like he basically named like fringe sort of Mets and had us rank them in order of how many plate appearances or innings pitched they had in their career as Mets, and sorted them into categories like infielders we thought would be better and like building a bullpen is hard and like things like that. And you'd be surprised how difficult that game was. I got a lot of it wrong. Like I was like, that guy pitched that many innings for the Mets? Good Lord.
I don't think I want to know.
No, you don't. For example, in one of the things, I think Drew Gagnon was number one on the list. Aww. And I was like, what? No, I had him like third on this list. Okay, fine. So yeah, that was fun. We played games. We drank a lot of good beers. The meetup was at the Ginger Man, and they have a fantastic beer selection. I had some really tasty beers, including a Belgian quad that was simply wonderful. So yeah, it was just a really good time. Had a really good day in the city. And then the next day, Michael and I explored a new brewery that I hadn't been to in New Jersey before, and that was really fun. So it was just a nice weekend. I really love when I get to see everybody at like BP Day, For All You Kids Out There meetups, the ARGs, like all the various like occasions we carve out of our very busy schedules to hang out with each other. It's always really nice. So that's my walk-off win for this week. So that does it for the show this week. Like I mentioned earlier, we are now taking a 2-week hiatus for the holidays. So I hope all of you enjoy your time with your families. If this time is a tough time for you, like it is for many during the holiday season, you are seen and loved, and we hope that you find peace this holiday season. In the meantime, you can check out AmazingAvenue.com, all of our fantastic content there. Check out our other pods, I shouted out Rob Wolf's pod before, Unformedable, fantastic, From Complex to Queens, and Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. Subscribe to the podcast. We're all on one feed, so it's really easy. Just hit subscribe to Amazing Avenue Audio, and you'll get all of our fantastic pods. You can follow us on Twitter, at A Pod of Their Own. You can follow each of us individually on Twitter. I am at Petite PhD. Where are you, Linda?
At Linda Servich.
And you, Maggie?
At Maggie162.
Follow all of us on Twitter. Follow the show on Twitter. The original music for the intro and the outro to this podcast is by Bunga. Let's go Mets. And don't forget, there is no crying in podcasting.
This episode is brought to you by the Dell XPS 13 2-in-1 laptop. The laptop for the binge watcher in all of us. From the Infinity Edge screen, to the booming bass, to the unparalleled battery life, the Dell XPS 13 2-in-1 has you covered. Plus, it looks real darn good. With materials like machined aluminum, carbon fiber, or woven glass fiber and weighing in at under 3 pounds, the outside is just as fancy as what's inside. The newly remastered XPS 13 2-in-1 from Dell with Dell Cinema Color, Sound, and Stream, powered by 10th Gen Intel Core processors. Find out more at 800 by Dell.